All right, Vinny. I tinkered with settings, so I'm in high def now. I didn't get a chance to get in touch with the guest, but from here on in, I'm going to see if I can get all of them to record in high def video for us too, to make it even better. So hopefully, cross your fingers, that's the way it works out, brother. All right. Thank you, buddy. Hello, Brian.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. Good to meet you.
You as well. First of all, just to start off with really quickly, that is one of my favorite fucking records of 2023, Unborn Ghost. What a, like, there's no way to actually describe it to someone. I've been hard pressed to by people that I've said, hey, you need to check this out. Well, what's it sound like? It's like, well, it's if you were to be asked to describe this record, how would you do so?
So like when you put out a record, I'm getting an echo. Are you recording already?
Yeah, but I mean, we
Oh,
could
okay.
like, am I echoing or what are you
I'm
getting?
hearing
What could
myself.
Huh, what do
Wait.
you?
I think it went away. It's faintly there, but it's not really bothersome, so it's fine.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah. When you put a record out and you have to get it distributed on like a digital distributor, you have to pick like a genre. And I think I picked something like post metal or something like that, which I'm not even sure exactly what that is supposed to be, but I felt like it at least sort of describes what the record is. I don't know. I mean, you're the music guy, right? So what would be How would you
Well,
describe it?
I would actually describe it as like a fusion, or even better, what would be the really bad, like abstract hardcore noise. Abstract hardcore noise would be the best way to just to describe it. Although it's not, it's only noise in so much as I can tell that you were interested in noise at one point in your life via the way it sounds. It doesn't sound like noise to me though. Like it's not Mare's Bow, it's not White House, it doesn't have that caustic wall of just vehemence and hatred that comes off of recordings like the two aforementioned artists. There's melodicism, there is metal in there. Yeah, I could tell you like black metal from aspects of the recording. But to me, it's almost like a massive stream of consciousness that's a revolving around a theme. That theme being like a massive fuck you to just about anyone or anything that doesn't align with the way you felt while you were recording it, which I really dig personally. I mean, to me, that's as pure a statement from an artist as you can possibly get, unfiltered, without trying to overcomplicate it or, turn it into this, intellectual think piece. It's just pure, like, fuck you. And it's great.
I'm glad you liked it. I mean, I don't know if I was trying to do that, but it was just sort of a pandemic project, really. Those are a bunch of songs I wrote 20 years ago when I was in college. It has sort of an undercurrent of misanthropy to it, but not in a angry, shouty kind of way, just more of a, like, some of it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, too. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know, kind of just my sense of humor, I guess. But yeah, I've had people describe, like, I've had more than one person say that there's rockabilly elements to one song.
Yeah.
Which I find odd, because I guess anytime that people hear, like, a walking bass line, they think it's a rockabilly song. It's not a rockabilly song at all. I'm glad you dug it. So that's cool.
Yeah, it got to live in a very specific place that it was an itch that no other album could have scratched, just because it had so many different influences and it wasn't up its own ass, which is refreshing too, because it seems like the more you go down the rabbit hole with independent music, the more people tend to take themselves more and more seriously. And I could dig that to a degree if, like, say, Neurosis is doing it. I love that they take themselves seriously because they're a deadly serious band. Swans the same way. But then you fall into these traps where people think they're these, like, misunderstood artists and they're all dark and brooding and mysterious. And it's really just, like, have fun and play fucking music already. You know? And yeah, that's what it's for.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know anyone, I guess, that takes themselves super seriously in music anymore. I'm sure there's people that do. It seems like that's probably hard to do nowadays when there's no money in it anymore. So, like, you know, very few musicians are, like, paying their rent by being an independent musician. So I think, like, that's probably humbling for a lot of people, which is a good thing, probably.
It probably is, but you know, in the same token, I think it limits a lot of what we do get to consume, because people are less and less want to go out and tour and record, because where's the money?
Yeah. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, because it does have it. I think that probably in the last 20 years, a lot of records didn't get made that would have been made in the 90s, because there would have been the ability to at least, like, make some money on it. But at the same time, when you're not doing something for your livelihood, I think that does give you a degree of freedom where you don't really have to worry about whether it's going to be successful or not. You're just doing what you wanted to do. So both of those things apply, I guess.
Yeah. I think. And, you know, taking all that into consideration, here you are running a label in the midst of all of it, and releasing some very interesting none of what comes out really has a unifying sound per se. Everything just seems to be like, this is what I like, so this is what I'm going to put out into the world. Was that kind of the impetus to that?
Yeah, I mean, the commonality for the releases that I've put out is just the fact that they aren't, pretty much none of them are traditional rock bands, like a four-piece band that has a set and they release albums and tour. They're all either solo artists or, like, duos. One of them's a trio, but that's just a studio project. So it's kind of, that does make it hard to recoup costs as well, because people buy merch at shows, and if all you're putting out is, like, lone weirdos in their apartment, then that opportunity doesn't exist. I mean, Little Theodore plays shows, Ralph occasionally plays shows, Ralph Jean. The Phonic Forest is long dissolved, I believe. On Pop Sound is a studio thing. Giddle and Boyd broke up 10 years or 15 years ago or whatever. So yeah, that's a problem, but I don't care, you know. It's like, I don't know. They're all unique and interesting weirdos with weird output. So,
and that's what's cool though, because you're providing a home for these, you know, weirdos to kind of be together and have, I don't know, like a home base almost for them. It makes me kind of long for the old days of like when there were labels such as yours that would take chances on, you know, bedroom projects and things like that. Like Triple R Records comes to mind, for example. I don't even know if he still runs that. It was a noise label, but he would release everyone from Thurston Moore to Maresbow to you name it. Just every oddball.
I actually don't know that label, but yeah, I mean, the labels that I've always really liked were the ones that had sort of a theme to them. Like I liked Estrus a lot. Mm-hmm. The kind of surf and garage label from, I think they're from Bellevue, Washington. It's kind of a 90s thing. And then, you know, Discord had its thing, and Lookout had its thing. I don't know, it's kind of a dying phenomenon. Although now there's this whole other weird, I don't know, in some ways it's like music, because you're probably about my same age, right? I'm in my mid-40s.
Yeah, I'm 47.
Okay, yeah. So it's not like it was in the 90s, but now you have these strange band camp labels that are like some guy that only puts out cassettes in a limited edition of 100, and they're all like just some super specific variant of like noise music or black metal or some like niche within a niche subgenre. And I've tried to, which is kind of frustrating for me, because it's like I've tried to work with those people, like, hey, I'm looking for distribution, but like they only do this very little tiny specific thing. They have no interest in any of the stuff that I put out, so it's unfortunate, but it's interesting. I mean, it's kind of cool that that's a thing for young people these days, at least.
And it's I think the young people nowadays, I have to kind of tip my hat to them, because as much as I want to be that curmudgeon that's like, oh, these fucking kids, they don't know what hardcore was like in the 80s. It's like, so what? Like, there was a lot of meathead bullshit that happened back then too, that you know, I could have done without. I think they're a lot more open-minded, and I think genre means less and less to these younger people.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting is you know, people always bitch as they get older about how music used to be good back when they were young or whatever. I don't really feel that way at all. I mean, I think, so a couple of my friends and I in the Bay Area in the 90s were really into the, what is now called like stoner doom. Mm-hmm. Like the Melvins and Sleep and King, Acid King, I don't know, brain fog there. But that was kind of it at the time. I mean, there was Fu Manchu, there was like Man's Ruin Records, but there wasn't really a whole scene of stoner doom. And I happened to live in the Bay Area where those bands happen to be.
Yeah.
But now, like, that's like an international scene, and you have like bands in Europe and bands in Scandinavia, and they're all really good. Like, they're yeah. better in a lot of ways than the original ones were. So I don't know. I don't have that view of oh, it used to be so great, you know.
It's I think we latch onto these things because, like, you know, in the 90s we had bands like Acid Bath, who are just so fucking weird and out there and incredible, and we think, oh, no one's ever going to be that revolutionary again, but it's happening, and it's going to continue to happen. You just have to resign yourself to the fact that what you grew up with is not all that special or revolutionary. It's just another wave of the same feelings and the same attributes. You know, you just got to ride the wave. You got to understand,
yeah.
Like, you know, I have a daughter who's in her 20s, and she brings music to me, and most of it's trite garbage, but some of it's fantastic. And I'm not going to, I always said to myself, I'm not going to be like what my old man was like when I would bring him Fugazi and shit like that. You'd be like, oh, that's bullshit. That's not like with the Doors and Hendrix. But it is, and it was, and it'll continue to be in perpetuity. As long as there's kids with something to shout about, there's always going to be that thing, you know? But I think what you're doing that's specifically very interesting too is the fact that on top of making your own music, running a label, you're also still actively publishing. You have a book coming out this year, correct?
I wish that was true. Now I put a placeholder for a book that I've been meaning to do for a long time, and I just haven't gotten around to. And I'm still kind of on the fence if I'm going to actually do it. I had a bunch of writings when I was young that seemed good at the time, and I haven't gone back and looked at them. It's been like my intention to kind of collect like just pieces I wrote for websites and magazines and blog stuff and interviews I did. But I don't know that it's going to stand the test of time and be worth publishing. maybe if it's heavily edited, I don't know. We'll see. But I haven't written anything in a while, but I did in the past, you know, or at least not for fun anyway.
But what I found interesting about your bibliography is it's almost like you tried just about everything, like from biography to, you know, like travel log almost, and essays, humor. Like you left no stone unturned throughout the entirety of your bibliography, which I felt was building to a crescendo at some point. Like you were going to reach this high watermark for yourself and be like, okay, this is where I'm going to end up, and then run with that.
Yeah. I mean, writing is, some of those things, a lot of people hate it, but I enjoy it. But at the same time, it's so similar to music where, you know, if once you reach a certain point in adulthood, there's only so many hours in a day and you got to pick what you're going to spend your time on. And if something isn't financially viable, you know, there's an opportunity cost associated with going down some pet project rabbit hole that you have, which is, you know, that's my record label is definitely that, but I don't know, it's fun and I just like doing it. Whereas with writing, I think I probably take it more seriously and like fixate on it more. And I really, unless I have something I want to write about, I really don't want to start on something and just have a half finished draft of something that never, because I've done that before and it's like just pointless, you know, like, but you know, I don't know, who knows, maybe I'll end up doing that in the future, but these things are all hobbies, you know.
But what's cool about your hobbies is you give them a life outside of, you know, the bedroom or the office. You're putting them out there for people to explore, and I wonder, like, what were the touchstones for you as a young man that kind of pushed you in that direction to be like, okay, I'm going to catalog this and let it live in the outer sphere, not just keep it to yourself and, you know, look back at it 20 years from now and be like, oh yeah, I remember I did that, and then throw it on a shelf again.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I started a label in high school. I was in a bunch of bands that were just kind of goofy suburban teenage projects. My friends and I had kind of a little scene. I should be accurate. I didn't start a label. I joined someone else's label and took it over. but it was like a set label, you know, local thing. And it just was fun and it was social, you know, being in bands, going to shows, playing shows. And it's fun to have an idea and then have the wherewithal to sit down and make it tangible. I mean, what you're talking about, putting it on the shelf, that, you know, I think there's a kind of a weird tragedy to that, that like most creative people who do music or books or whatever, they have some idea that they want to do and it spins around in their head for decades and then they never put it out there. Nowadays, there's kind of not really an excuse for that anymore because you can self-publish, you can put out stuff online, even if it's not in physical media, music-wise. Filmmaking's a little trickier. I know a filmmaker who, you know, it's the same situation in indie film. Like, people don't buy tangible media really anymore. So that's got to be something you've got to want to do. I mean, I'm speaking merely for someone like me. Like, I mean, I do know people that are successful enough at what they like to do that that's their job. I just don't have any illusions about that. So I don't even aim for that.
Right.
But
the thing I find myself wondering, because I just based on your tastes, I can tell that you come from punk and hardcore and, you know, metal and things like that. I'm talking about from a literary standpoint. Who were the voices, the authors that kind of moved you in your youth to want to commit to the written word and publish and let people see it?
You know, I wish I had a good answer for that. When I was in my early 20s, I ended up living in Europe. I was an exchange student in college, and then I taught English after I graduated, and I just started blogging and just about like my life and what I'm doing. Cause I, like, this is like late 90s up to like maybe 2000. And just so I could kind of stay in touch with my friends back in the States, and got a fairly positive response to that. And people kept telling me like they read my stuff and thought it was good, and their friend's friend read it and thought it was good or whatever. And then at a certain point I was like, oh, I guess I could take this more seriously. As far as what you mean, like into like what authors I liked?
Maybe not so much authors, but just writers in general. It could be like, you know, Maximum Rock and Roll. It could be, you know, whatever. What were you reading that sparked your interest initially to want to commit word to paper?
I think, you know, a lot of the stuff Feral House was putting out back then.
Yeah.
Research, zines.
Zines were big for me, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird, like now it's we live in this digital age, but back in the day, as you know, like zines would be like you'd go to the store and buy a paper zine because that was the only way that people could get stuff out, at least on their own. And then small press stuff. I don't know. I mean, I've read a lot of authors over the years, and I have like a list of favorites or whatever. But I don't, as a young person, I wasn't that into it. Like, I wasn't one of these bookworm people, really. You know.
Yeah.
I didn't really get into reading until my 20s, probably. I think the music in high school for sure was a big deal.
Yeah, I think we all kind of, as much as I was a bookworm from a very very young age, music informed that for me like heavily, because even before I found my own music, when I was a devotee of my father's tastes in music, you know, I was listening to the Doors and the Rolling Stones, and I'd read liner notes. Very sure. Little small child. I learned how to read when I was three, just like my young son learned when he was 3 years old. And I would just pore over liner notes of albums. And I remember specifically David Bowie's Diamond Dogs and the first Doors album, just cracking both of those open and reading them and being mystified by them. And then I found T-Rex the Slider, and that changed the course of my whole fucking life, because that record still to this day to me has a very special place. There's something metaphysical about that album. But yeah, it was music. It was lyrics, you know,
T-Rex is good. I mean, it's those, that and the other one, with Bang a Gong on it, is really good.
Oh, oh shit. Electric Warrior.
Yeah.
But there's something otherworldly about artists that, you know, reach across generations. And I think what you've done with Unborn Ghost has that ability, because it doesn't, it's not anchored to this generation at all. It's not anchored to any generation, really. And I think that's the magic about it, because you could put it on and be in the 90s. You could put it on and be in 2030. And it's not tethered. It's not tethered to, you know, a hardcore record, a metal record, a grunge record, a this or that. It gets to kind of be its own thing. And I think that's another reason why I dug it so much, because it's it's its own particular beast.
Yeah, I mean, well, as I was saying, I wrote those songs a long time ago, and then I had sort of intended to record them at various times, and I've moved around a lot between the end of the 2000s to now. And at one point, another person was going to be in it, and that kind of didn't work out. But it's sort of a hodgepodge of like stuff I just had written and been playing for years, and then the pandemic happened, and I was like, I should just use this time to record all this stuff and try to put it into a package. So that's kind of why it's all over the place, because it's not like I sat down and was like, I'm going to write a bunch of hardcore songs or pop punk songs or country songs or whatever. But it is kind of all in the same mood, I hope, anyway.
No, it's tethered together. I think that record is seamless in so far as it, how cohesive it is. It's not as if it's so far flung that, like, you know, one sounds like the Wesley Willis fiasco and one sounds like fucking Slayer. You know what I mean? It's everything. It came from the same guy. It's obvious.
That would be an interesting album.
I'd listen to it.
Yeah.
God rest Wesley Willis. Wonderful human.
I never met him, but I hear he was a sweetheart.
He was, but he headbutted me so fucking hard that he almost knocked me out.
Really?
That was how he showed that he liked you.
Yeah.
Wesley always had...
He had the big lump on his forehead, yeah.
Yeah,
I know people that made a documentary about him. I don't know if it ever came out, but everyone says good things about that guy.
Yeah, he's wonderful, wonderful person.
Not really a big fan of his music, though. It's one of those things, like, I get the appeal, but it just never grabbed me.
Yeah, I mean, it's... You heard one, you kind of heard them all. That might be the charm of it. Also, it's its downfall, but I mean, he had his limitations. He was working within his set of limitations, and he found his niche and it worked for him. And he was damn fun to watch.
Didn't he have like schizophrenia or something? Or
chronic schizophrenia. He had a song about it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, sort of Daniel Johnson similarly had some, or has some sort of psychiatric ailment. I don't know what it is, but
he's autistic.
Okay.
and right. Now that's somebody I grew up loving.
He has some real hits. I don't own any of his records. I like don't know any of them, but I know there's a couple that are like real earworms, real catchy.
Yeah, and childlike in its wonder of the world. Which yeah. I found especially appealing in the early 90s when I first came upon him when I was like running a college radio show. And, you know, you find these things and they have their place in your life. And then you kind of put them on a shelf. It's not often that something becomes so ubiquitous that it sticks with me forever. There are things that do, obviously. But it's got to really... move me in a very deep soul wrenching sort of way. That's why bands like Neurosis, I will always carry Neurosis with me, because first time I heard them, they were this crazy D beat crusty fucking punk band and turned into this juggernaut, this steamroller of a psychedelic demonic thing. And they're one of the few that I will always cherish in my heart of hearts. Do you have anyone like that? Any band, any musician that you've kind of always kept as like in your back pocket as that one?
Gosh. I mean, there's just certain bands that like during a certain period of their career, I just love it, but then they invariably move on and kind of change their sound, and I don't always hate it, but I don't really love it. Like the Boner Records era of the Melvins, like that stuff blew my mind as a teenager. And I still like the Melvins. I just haven't seen them in a long time, and because they were in the Bay Area, I saw them a lot. I saw Neurosis a lot too as a teenager. But I just haven't kept up with their catalog because they just have, and it's like, I think it's part of like, just getting old. Like, I, you know, like, I love the shit that I love, and I like, okay, the new stuff's cool, but like, man, this is the another one is, and this is like probably I don't know what the kids say, cringe, I guess, but late 90s Radiohead.
Oh, it's great.
I think is amazing. Like,
it's fucking great. It's fucking great.
Yeah, the bends, and then particularly like the all the like B-sides from that era, like that didn't make it on an album.
The Seatbelt, you know, the one, it's a maxi single. Fuck, I have it too.
So like, I don't, yeah, I, the weird thing is, so they're British, and there's like this whole different thing in the UK with singles where like something will be a single, but it's like 25 minutes and has five songs on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, all that stuff that didn't make it on the record, I thought it was really good. Same thing for the OK Computer stuff. And then after that, you know, I mean, I like some of their stuff, but some of it I just absolutely can't stand at all.
It became unlistenable. Like, it became very unlistenable.
Like, it's not even the same kind of music. It's like obnoxiously trying to be avant-garde.
Yeah, it's up its own ass. Like I said before, I hate the fact that, you know, a band like Radiohead, who I didn't like Pablo Honey. I thought it was kind of
trite. It's not. It has like three good songs on it.
Yeah.
It's kind of a lot of filler. Yeah.
And
I mean, look, I have no right to say that. Like, I've done one record, and like, no business saying that like Radiohead is like mediocre or whatever.
No, but I'm not. We're saying we don't like it. There's a difference. It's a matter of taste, not a matter of station with us.
Sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And I didn't like that first record. And then the Bends came out, and maybe it's because I was a bit older when the Bends came out. I was in college instead of high school, but that record had an emotional maturity and, you know, a sense of play. Like they were really feeling what it was to be musicians. They weren't just like writing verse, chorus, verse anymore. They were really getting into weirdo shit.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And I dug the fuck out of that. I thought they did it really well with OK Computer as well. And Kid A and Amnesiac, they lost me.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. There's situations like that. I mean, I guess bands that are like infallible to me, the only one I can think of would be like the Mummies.
Mm-hmm.
Something about the Mummies, I just like what they are and what they did and what they're about and how they did it. I've never seen them live. And I kind of don't want to, because I feel like it would ruin my my perception of how amazing the Mummies are. I liked Big Black a lot.
Yeah.
In the 80s, or sorry, the 90s. I was a kid in the 80s. But like post Big Black stuff, not really.
Like, no Redman or Shellac or any of that.
I saw Shellac a couple times. I mean, I don't know, I feel like I'm talking shit about these big name artists here, but like their first 7 inches were really good, and then I again sort of lost, just never really followed up, you know. So maybe they have the good stuff and I just haven't, maybe I need to get out of my little box, I guess, but yeah, I don't know.
I find getting out of your box to be a little overrated though too, because I remember, God, what was it, like 1991, 92, some of my contemporaries in the hardcore punk scene in the Northeast were starting to get into like the beginnings of the jam band shit. And I remember Phish came out and they were all like, oh, you need to check out. We were all in jazz bands together, myself and a whole bunch of other people who were in the hardcore scene as well. And they were like, check out this. Like, you like Frank Zappa? Yes, of course. I love Frank Zappa. I grew up on Frank Zappa. Check this out. And it was like the first Phish record or something. And I remember I brought it home. I listened to 45 seconds of the first song and I turned it off and I put it right back in my book bag. And I couldn't wait to get back to school the next day to tell my friend what a heaping, festering pile of garbage he handed to me. And this is no offense to anyone that listens to Phish, likes Phish. I'm sure they're talented. I'm sure it's well done, but it's trite, goofy, drug-induced garbage in the worst possible way anything could be drug-induced garbage. And I grew up loving drugs.
Okay.
You know what?
I mean, one of the things about that is, like, when you're young, at least people our age, I feel like music was sort of part of your identity. Mm-hmm. I never externalized that. I never had weird hair or tattoos. I didn't dress like a punk rocker, but I was very into music. And so therefore, like, your whole friend group is into that stuff. But now that I'm older, it's like I have friends that listen to the music that I have zero commonality with at all, and I don't care. It's like, it's just not me. Yeah. They wouldn't know any band we just mentioned in the last 20 minutes besides Radiohead.
Right.
And they might not even know that very well. And so, like, yeah, I had a buddy who was really into Fish and Dave Matthews and all this other stuff that, like, I agree with you. It's not my cup of tea. That doesn't mean it's not competent or technically difficult or whatever. It just doesn't speak to me at all. But a lot of underground music doesn't either. Like, you know.
Sure.
Like,
and I certainly wouldn't lose a friend over it. Like, even then, all of my friends who got into the hippie and rave, like the hardcore, we used to say the hardcore retirement home was the rave scene, because a lot of our friends would leave hardcore and go be ravers. I wouldn't stop being friends with them.
Sure.
Actually, to the contrary, I would be like, yo, bring me back some shit. But I wouldn't be caught dead at the show. You know?
Yeah, well, that's not. Yeah, there's lots. Even bands I like, I don't necessarily have the patience to go see them live anymore. You know, it's like occasionally there's one or two that are really good. Although I did get into psychedelic music in the last 10 years, maybe. I lived in LA and there's kind of a good psych scene there. There's these bands like Dead Meadow, mm-hmm. and The Warlocks. That whole scene, the Black Angels, they're not from LA, but I've seen all those bands live and they're pretty good.
Yeah, I like that stuff, but to me, that's not hippie. That's its own thing.
Yeah, it isn't hippie music. It's, I don't know exactly what kind of person listens to that music, but it's good.
Well, to me, if someone who listens to psychedelic music, if you look at it from a 60s standpoint, there were the hippies, then there were the people who were cool enough to go to the Church of Satan. The psychedelic people went to the Church of Satan and hung out with Dr. LaVey. You know what I mean? Like, to me, sure. That's the delineation there.
Right. There's like the New York versus California thing. Yeah.
I do sort of actually miss that part of the 90s and the 80s, when Dr. LaVey was still alive and still lording over the Church of Satan as it stood before it was irrevocably changed. Just the fact that he was in the world still, I think there was still mystery left in the world when he was alive, because he was a funny guy. And Farrell House used to put out his writings, and he put out one book specifically that I really, really love, called Satan Speaks. And it was just a book of his essays and thoughts on the world. And when you really got to the kernels of what he was talking about in that book, he was like talking about how cool it was to be an older guy and have a kid. Like, you know, he was a normal ass guy who just so happened to have a really interesting take on humanism and marketed it really, really well.
Yeah, I've known a number of people that knew him pretty well and spoke highly of him. But it was one of those things, like, I was always peripherally aware of that scene, but I was never really a part of it. And he's influenced a lot of people that I like, though. So,
oh, yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of strange how that's kind of gone off the rails, I guess, in the last 10 years or however long he's been dead. It's sort of a different organization with a different worldview than it was, I guess. I don't know. I mean, that's just what I hear, but yeah, I'm not surprised that if you're into all this weird shit, that you're into that too, because everyone, it's the same crowd of people. But I just, yeah, I never got into it. I don't know.
It seems like a lot of my friends, especially musicians, were kind of like 2 degrees of separation from Dr. LaVey. It's just something that keeps coming up, be it like even like Vag Moore, like didn't know Dr. LaVey, but knew people who knew Dr. LaVey, and you know, it always sort of comes back to this esotericism in my life anyway, where the people I surround myself with, no matter if I'm consciously or subconsciously aligning myself with these people, they're always ultimately, if not into that sort of thing, they know people intimately who are into that sort of thing. I don't know if we smell our own and just draw it to us, but that's been like the story of my life, really.
Yeah, I must have something wrong with me, because I know lots of people that are into that world of the esoteric and the occult. Badge is one, Sean Partridge is another, Lloyd Rice, Matt Skiba, and I disagree with all of them about it. Like, I like them all, and I enjoy talking to them, and I enjoy their insight into how they see the world, but I'm an atheist, and I just have no... I have no interest in the occult. Right. It can be interesting aesthetically, and it's interesting how it upsets, I guess the word is normies. But it's just not the lens through which I see the world, really. But everyone around me does, pretty much. Not everybody, but I don't care, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Where does that come from for you? Being that I know quite a few atheists, but I never seem to get down to the conversation of what was the aha moment for you where you said to yourself, wow, there really is nothing.
Well, so the term atheism is sort of a misnomer. Like, if you're really technical about it, even hardcore atheists, if you drill down, usually are like agnostic, because that's kind of the only intellectually honest position. You can't know something that's unknowable. So I guess technically I'm an agnostic. I'm just not persuaded by particularly organized religion, but you know, most spirituality stuff just doesn't resonate with me. I don't know. I mean, this is a music podcast. We could talk about this if you want.
Listen, if you were to sit down and actually like analyze every episode of my podcast, music's the first 20 to 30 minutes tops. And then it's just all about like me trying, like we're sitting in a bar together and I'm just trying to get to know you, like, you know, and that's what it is, man.
I got sort of interested in the scientific skepticism movement around 2008, I would say, probably through encountering Michael Shermer's work, and then simultaneously Penn and Teller's Bullshit. Yes. You know, if you've seen that show.
Oh, very, I watched every episode.
Yeah. And then reading like Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World, some of Sam Harris's stuff, I found pretty persuasive. I disagree with a lot of the people in that world on other issues besides religion and science. Some of them have kind of gone off the rails vis-a-vis politics and culture war issues. But on the question of like, you know, religion or the occult, I think they're correct. So it's kind of an awkward position to be in for me, but this is how I see it, I guess.
I don't see how that could really be awkward, though. If you're coming by it honestly, it's
not. Yeah, I mean, I don't really like get off on arguing with people. You know, 15 years ago, I might like get in some argument with someone on Facebook or something about something, but now I just don't have the time or the energy. So people can believe whatever the fuck they want. But if I'm asked and you're asking, then I'll give my opinion. Yeah, that's kind of where I come from.
It's something I've opined with atheist friends of mine who, you know, they don't take your perspective. They're very almost religious.
Yeah, no, I know. Atheists are some of the most insufferable blowhards in the world, because they feel like they're almost like conspiracy theorists where, oh, I have this all figured out. I have this special knowledge and I need to show you how smart I am and you're stupid. And I probably went through some version of that 15 years ago or whatever. I mean, I've definitely been an obnoxious person in my life, but, you know, it's just kind of like, it's not really worth arguing with people about. Like, I feel like a lot of people come to their position on these issues for a suite of reasons that are not, like, you know, coldly reasoned out, and you're not going to disabuse them of some belief system that's, like, intertwined with their identity. Right. So it's not worth your time. Like, but atheists love to do that, and they're not good salesmen for that worldview, because they're obnoxious assholes. And I mean I've been an obnoxious asshole. I probably still am an obnoxious asshole, but I don't know. I guess I'm just older and I don't care, you know. Like,
and I think that's the healthiest kind of place to be. I mean, myself, I grew up Catholic, and mysticism has always been, like, in my purview, but in my heart of hearts, I've been waiting for something like that whole time. I've seen some weird shit. You could chalk it up to a lot of different things in my life. It doesn't equal God. It just equals weird shit. And I'm still waiting for something to prove to me that it's, you know, there and omnipotent. I don't know what that makes me. I don't think I need to put a name on that. I'm not hurting for that either. You know, I don't need that to identify me. I've been pretty comfortable in who I am for a very long time. I don't need someone's church or someone's word or term to put a blanket over me and make me feel cuddly and safe. Like, I'm this, you know, cause what the fuck?
That's probably just being intellectually honest and being mature. And if you're willing to change your mind and say, like, I mean, I'm willing to change my mind. It's not a huge issue for me either. Like, religion. I guess we're talking about it, but, like, I wasn't raised with or without it. One of my parents was Catholic nominally, but, like, didn't really make a big fuss about it. The other, I think, was probably an agnostic. But it's like, I've also known atheists that, their whole thing is, like, rebelling against their upbringing. Like, they were, you know, raised by crazy Pentecostal Christians or whatever, and now they need to go prove that, you know, that was all bullshit or whatever. Which I guess I understand that impulse, but it's not really an objective way of looking at things. But yeah, I could change my mind on that issue, I suppose. You know, I doubt it's going to happen, but it could. You know, people know who Ayaan Hirsi Ali is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she was like a public figure atheist, and now I guess has become a Christian recently. Mm-hmm. It's kind of odd, but, like, okay. Like,
hey,
I have not read her book or her. She did, like, an article or whatever explaining why she converted to Christianity. I can't imagine what the reasons were that are persuasive, but maybe, who knows? You know, I haven't read it, so.
Right. No, and nor have I, but I think you and I kind of arrived at a similar impasse for the same reasons, though, because my mom, ultra Catholic, my dad, Vietnam veteran, lost his faith in a battlefield in Vietnam. So, like, I had that dichotomy going for me. So it was a recipe for open-mindedness, I think, in all reality, because you do have these two opposing, diametrically opposing sides ping-ponging your psyche around. You're gonna find a middle point just for a baseline, you know.
But you know, on the other hand, one of those two might be right, and it's not necessarily the golden mean, right? Like, maybe your mom's right, or maybe your dad's right, and the other one's just completely wrong. I don't know,
it just felt more comfortable for me to find the baseline between the two and be like, I like that, because this is didactic and this is didactic. I'm going that way where I'm not going to be judged. And I think that's indicative of not only where we spiritually ended up, but maybe musically and culturally where we ended up too, because, you know, there was like, especially our age group, there were the jocks and the preppy dudes that we were kind of surrounded with in our high school situations. And then there were like the straight heshers who I always liked their music, but they were always a bit too extreme for me in the way they lived their lives, like huffing paint and shit like that. And I'm not trying to paint that picture of the world at large, but in my high school in 1989, the heshers were in, you know, Metallica and Megadeth t-shirts, huffing paint under their porches and doing shit like that. That doesn't mean every metalhead did, but where I'm from, they did. I didn't want to go there.
You grew up in Pennsylvania?
Yes. Yes, okay. Scranton, Pennsylvania area, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I've never spent a lot of time there. I mean, I've been to Philadelphia, but I have family from upstate New York, so I do have some experience on the East Coast. But I grew up on the West Coast. The metalheads were metalheads there, though, the same. I mean, I don't know if they were sniffing huffing paint or whatever, but they were all smoking pot. And, you know, I mean, it's a cliche for a reason, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess to kind of paint you a picture of what Northeastern Pennsylvania was in those times, I'm sure you've seen the movie River's Edge.
It's been a while, but yeah, I have seen it. Yeah.
It was pretty fucking much like that.
Okay.
So you had those dudes who I liked their music and didn't want to hang with them. And then there were the ultra preppy, ultra douchey football players and preppy dudes. I wasn't going that way either. Punk rock was the perfect. It was that perfect spot where I could go and skate. And there was already a scene around here, which for Nowheresville, Pennsylvania seems unlikely, but we had a very thriving one, still do, but back in the late 80s, it was really, really big. So it wasn't so out of place for me in seventh grade to be going to see 7 Seconds and shit like that. So I had that going for me. If there's one thing about maybe this generation that I think I had over them is it was dangerous. It was very dangerous to be who I was in 1987-88. It's not dangerous to be much of anything right now, and that's not a bad thing, that's a good thing. I don't wish upon the young people of this generation to have to, you know, run from people who are chasing them down just because they're going to go skateboard or go to a show. But it was a rarefied thing back then, for sure. I'm sure your upbringing was similar.
Yeah, I mean, I always dressed like a square. I've had the same haircut my whole life. I think it's one of these things, like, I kind of got teased about it and decided, like, well, fuck you, this is who I am then, kind of thing, as in, you know, as a middle schooler. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Back in the day, people who had tattoos, you were either in a gang, like a motorcycle gang, or you'd been to prison, or you were just, like, a scumbag. Mm-hmm. And now all the hot girls on Instagram have tattoo. Everyone has a fucking tattoo. I don't have any tattoos, but I'm like the only person I know who doesn't have a tattoo.
I think that's the coolest fucking thing I've heard in a long time, though, because I'm covered in them, and there's no rebellion in this anymore, man. There's like, this signifies nothing.
But it used to. There was a time when, yeah, that was a very, like they call them job stoppers for a reason, you know, like the knuckle ones. Like, yeah, I've known friends that have neck tattoos and the knuckle tattoos. And now that kind of, I'm sure there's a context where that can still adversely impact your employment options, but it's nothing like it used to be. Like, you were an outlaw in the 80s if you had tattoos.
Fuck yeah.
And it was the same with like dyeing your hair. You know, I remember there would be like maybe 3 or 4 people in my high school who had dyed hair, and they were like the extreme punk weirdos. And now, you know, if you don't dye your hair, you're not fitting into the, but like, we sound like a couple of old fucking assholes saying this, right? Like, this is just like, I'm sure you've lost half your listeners at this point.
Well, the thing that I think kind of like brings my younger listeners in, though, is the fact that I say it every episode. I think that they have it all over us in all reality. And I think they're very fortunate too, because they don't have that animosity and that pushback that we had to deal with. We had to put up with that so they didn't have to. And that's important. And that's,
yeah,
that's,
I don't know. I mean, I get what you're saying and I sort of agree, but I do not envy young people growing up today at all.
Well, it's a shit world now.
Well, I mean, it's always been a shit world. I mean, your father fought in Vietnam. That was shitty. It's always been shitty. It's always shitty somewhere anyway. But being a teenager in a world of like social media and the internet, and just screens everywhere, I don't know. I'm kind of glad that I got to have one foot in the pre-digital age and one foot in the early days of the internet. And who knows what'll happen next, but I think it's probably pretty fucking tough to be a young person right now for totally different reasons. Like, yeah, you're not going to get stomped by jocks or whatever, but you like literally there's no escaping the social scene in your little life because everything's on the internet 24/7. That's got to be bizarre for a 12-year-old. Not to mention like pornography, like, oh, you know, like, I mean, when I was in high school, pornography, we had like one adult bookstore in our town and it was like a taboo thing that nobody talked about and no one admitted to ever having seen pornography. And now it's just ubiquitous. And it also seems pretty extreme nowadays. And that's got to be a strange environment to grow up in too.
It is, because I remember catching like the whiff of sex from my being, like I mentioned before, a young reader. I was maybe 11 when I'd gone to the drugstore in my very small town and purchased Clive Barker's Books of Blood. I think it was like the maybe part one or part two. I'm not sure. I picked that up. I read through it. There's some pretty sexual shit in there. And then maybe like 2 months later, I'd already become a ravenous fan. And I found the Hellbound Heart novella in the same store. And I was picking up tampons for my mother.
Okay, that's
great. And I had changed.
Great thing for a kid to be known.
Right. Well, sorry. I'm the oldest of six kids. I'm the one who gets sent down to the local drugstore to get that shit. And, you know, to maybe assuage my embarrassment, I took her change and I bought Hellbound Heart. I come home and talk about sex, just like the most depraved S&M tinged sex that was beyond pornography, and I'd probably never actually seen anything outside of a dirty magazine at this point in my life. And I'm sitting and I'm reading this and it's bending my very young mind in so many beautiful ways. But can you imagine,
how old were you at this time?
11.
Yeah, it's pretty young.
I was 11 when I read Pet Sematary as well. But I was younger. I'm sorry. I was younger than 11 when I read Pet Sematary. I was 10. But, you know, coming upon these things, it's innocent now in all reality when you think about it, because I'm reading it in a book.
Right. I guess.
The pornography that is kind of like the peanut butter and jelly of the internet now for these young people, it's fucking mind-boggling. And there's no keeping kids away from it unless they're not allowed to be on the internet anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to come off as being like censorious or whatever, but it's just, no. I just think it's probably pretty fucking weird to be a 12-year-old in 2024, with just unlimited access to infinite amounts of porn. I don't know how healthy that is for young people, but I also don't know that, I mean, in practical terms, like, what's the solution to that, and what's the right balance between, you know, being a prude or being a libertine? I don't, you know, I don't have children, so I don't have to think about this stuff. But
well, all of that being said, what's very interesting is I recently read that the instances of teen pregnancy and underage sex have gone down exponentially in the past 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of have a, I don't even know if I want to discuss this kind of shit, but like, I sort of have a pet theory about, like, one of the reasons that, and this probably is not my idea at all, but one of the reasons so many young girls are they thems now is they just probably have been exposed to porn and just want nothing to do with sex.
It makes sense.
See all this fucking choking and puking and S&M, and they're like 13 or whatever, and they're like, yeah, that, I'm good, I'm a they them, I'm not gonna get, I'm not doing that, you know, like, which,
yeah,
I wouldn't blame them, you know.
No, I mean, I couldn't imagine being a young lady in that environment. It just, ugh.
Well, God. Like thinking that that's what sex is and thinking that that's what you're supposed to do, I could totally see why you'd be like, fuck that. I'm cutting my hair and I'm wearing overalls and dyeing my hair blue and you can call me they. You know, as a preteen, like, but yeah, I don't know. That's for the sociologist.
Did you minor in sociology?
No. Okay. I'm just saying, like, I'm just a guy talking on a podcast. Like, I don't fucking have any data on that.
I just would have found it amusing because you majored in English, right?
I actually majored in art.
Oh, okay.
In Spanish. Yeah, I was in the art world a little bit for a little while, but that was a long time ago. Go ahead.
No, I would have found it funny because I majored in English and minored in soc. That's why I don't know why I thought you had majored in English, but
yeah, I feel like sociology is one of those things people don't know what they're doing, so they pick that.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. 100%. What am I going to minor in? So hit me.
Yeah. I mean, there's always funny degrees like media studies or whatever. anything with studies at the end is not a real major. Sorry. But like,
no, it's the truth.
Studies, gender studies, like whatever. Like, sorry.
Well, I remember I'm at NYU. It's 1992. I'm trying to like figure out, okay, I know I want to be a writer. What am I going to major in? Literature, English lit. Hit me. Yeah, because I'm going to get a fucking job doing that. I'll tell you what I do for a living a little later, but it's not that. And
you mean you're not an English literature, you don't produce English literature to pay your rent? I'm shocked.
I'm a fucking plumber.
Well, hey, I mean, that's where things are going nowadays. Like, you can make a decent living in the trades now, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, better to have the ability to be a plumber than to have a degree in philosophy or something. Nothing against philosophy as a degree, but...
No, but that's...
practical. Yeah.
That's what I was doing, basically, you know? Like, English lit. Okay, I want to be Clive Barker when I grow up at that point, you know? So, like, I'm 17 years old and away from home for the first time. I'm like, English lit. Let's do it. What's your minor? Sociology.
Right.
Little kid making big boy decisions with a lot of money.
Did you have to take out student loans?
Yeah, but here's the thing. I was a decent athlete. So that kind of stemmed some of the tide of the finances, but it's not like NYU had a great baseball program. It was just enough for me not to starve, you know.
That's nice.
Yeah, that was decent, but you know, like I don't even think college was for my education. I think it was for the 4 years of becoming the person I was going to be for the rest of my life and enjoying New York City and getting to live that punk rock life that I'd always, you know, had been striving for in Pennsylvania and dreamed of, and then got to New York, got to realize it. And then come back here and become a plumber like my dad. But it was a great time. You know, I don't know if that was what college was for you. I mean, you got to grow up in the Bay Area, though. Like, that's a whole different kind of thing, I would think.
I mean, yeah, I grew up in the suburbs, the East Bay. Like, people hear East Bay, they think of, like, Oakland. But there's, like, a little mountain range. And then there's a bunch of suburbs on the other side. That's where I grew up. So I was able to go to the city, but I didn't live there. Yeah, I mean, the suburbs are the suburbs everywhere in America, I think. And not just America, anywhere in the Western world. Like, you could be in suburban Dublin, Ireland, and it's probably the same as suburban, you know, Pennsylvania, in many respects, at least.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not like it was exciting growing up. And people have a weird concept of California in general. It's either really good or really bad, you know, and some of both of those are true, but...
Well, I got to kick around Tenderloin in San Francisco when I was a kid, okay, because that's where my uncle lived. So I have two, I have two different versions of the Bay. You know, I have San Francisco, which, you know, in the 80s was kind of a ton of fun. And then Tenderloin, which Dave Chappelle famously said is the opposite of tender, and he's 100% right. It was pretty, it was like a war zone, at least then.
Yeah, it's really, really rough. It's never not been. I mean, I haven't been there in probably 15 years, but I've never heard anything good about it, you know?
It's like, no, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's a seriously weird place. L.A. has a version of that, too, called Skid Row.
Like, yeah.
That's the actual name of the neighborhood is Skid Row.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they're both fucked. I mean... I don't know.
Venice was pretty fucked back then too, to be honest with you.
In Los Angeles?
Yeah. Venice in the 80s was fucking crazy. Limited exposure, mind you. Like, I was just, you know, coming in to visit my favorite uncle who, you know, taught at Berkeley. And, you know, like, that was my summer experience when I was a kid. So I got to see a lot of things. I got to experience the Bay very briefly in little increments, but of course my vision of it is still going to be skewed because I didn't actually get to grow up there, so sure. I may not have a clear picture of it. The glory days of it for me are just, you know, getting to see the few shows I got to see when I'd go there, and I thought the people were a lot more chill to my face and a lot more phony behind my back than on the East Coast, where everybody was really fucking mean to your face, but it was sincere. That's the difference.
A stereotype. I mean, I had family on the East Coast and I went there a few times in the 80s and the 90s. And, you know, yeah, there's some truth to all that. I mean, the main difference though is just like a fuck lot more Dunkin' Donuts on the East Coast. That's true. You know, they're everywhere. It's bizarre to me. I currently live in Denver, which is neither of these two things. I really like it in Denver. Denver has its own weird idiosyncrasies, I guess. Yeah, I mean, that is the stereotype of like California. I don't know if it's accurate or not, because I feel like I swam in it, right? So,
yeah.
But it seems pretty dysfunctional now in a lot of ways. Maybe it always was. Ever since like the dot-com era, it's just like there's a lot of money in the Bay Area. And it's kind of a mess. Like, the crime problem is fucked. I haven't lived there in a while, so, you know, I guess I shouldn't speak out of turn. But LA is also a mess. The last few years, I mean, I haven't been there in maybe a year and a half. But we're getting some of that in Denver, too. We're getting some of those same issues, but it's not nearly as bad, at least as far as I understand.
But being a kid, the first thing that came to mind about, you know, getting to go to the Bay to see my uncle was, yo, Crimp Shrine's there, man. Jeff Ott's there. I got to go see that. Like, I got to go be a part of that. And you get there and you start to realize, like, yo, Jeff Ott's fucking homeless. Like, these guys are, they're only famous in name. Like, there's no glitz and glamour to it. Like, what they're singing about is actually kind of happening to them. You know,
yeah, and that was all pre Green Day too, right? I mean,
like, yes, very. So,
yeah, I don't know what those people. I mean, I'm aware of that band, but who knows what if they made money at some point and they, what, you know? But like, yeah, I mean, I think prior to the late, I guess it was the mid '90s, probably a lot of that stuff that you were into, like, yeah, those people really were like not making any money any more than they are now, right? Like,
yeah,
kind of come so full circle in a way where it's like independent filmmakers and writers and musicians are just struggling to just kind of even get by. But that you know, that wasn't the case for a while, but it seems like it is again.
But I think though, like, as sad as it is to say, like, what we going back to what we were talking about in the beginning about there being, you know, an honesty in the fact that you have to be a working class artist, musician, author, whatever it is. There's the double-edged sword to it, but it almost seems like to me right now there is almost an embarrassment of riches to some degree, because even though they're niche and they're small and they're not putting out massive amounts of records, there's so many different labels, artists, like, for whatever you're into. Yeah. It's there right now. I think you're fulfilling a big part of a niche as well, because everybody needs that little place to go, you know. Sure. for the people who dig, I don't know how to, like, the post-punk dream pop thing. There's probably 25 labels that I personally deal with. Their artists come on the show. Same thing with hardcore, same thing with noise. I think you get to have an upper hand in a way, because you don't have to kowtow to any of these, like, genres. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have hardcore bands knocking down your door or noise or this or that, but it's in the name. You get to discriminate who gets to come on and be in that tight circle. Is that kind of why you named it that?
I think I was just looking for a name at the time. I mean, I started in 2004. I fiddled around with a bunch of different names, and that was the one that kind of stuck. I think it kind of fits, you know. I haven't put out enough stuff. I want to put out more stuff, but each thing is like, I mean, I have a job, you know, so like I kind of work on it on the weekend. The pandemic was a good opportunity to like get stuff done, and that's coming down now. So I don't really have the free time anymore that I did to work on things. But I'm hoping to put out more things. But it is true. Like I just kind of, when I get around to it or when I feel like it, I'll do something, and then hopefully people dig it. If they don't, that's okay. You know?
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Logo too, by the way. There's something just really cute yet creepy about the logo, about the vampire, like, just
yeah, that was drawn by an Australian illustrator who does like poster art, Glenn Smith. His handle is like Gleno, like one word. Yeah, I commissioned him to do that. I was pretty impressed with this stuff.
It's based on a cookie. Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
That's based on a cookie cutter that I, for a Halloween cookie, like a 60s, like cookie cutter set of just like, there was a vampire and, you know, like a pumpkin and a bat. And I guess I'm told that when I was a little kid, I drove my mother crazy by insisting that she make the vampire cookies year round. And so I kind of like picked that as the logo, but then I had it redesigned because I want to have the copyright to it. So it's similar to the cookie cutter, but it's different enough that it's kind of its own thing.
I was going to say, it kind of reminds me of one of the vacuum form masks we would have worn as kids in the 80s, you know, going trick-or-treating. Maybe that's part of the draw for it to me. But, you know, I don't know. I think that there's a certain personality type that is drawn to the vampire as an image, not in the Twilight sense or in the gothy sense. But when I was a kid, young kid, I think every year for the first 7 years I went trick-or-treating, I was a vampire every year.
Oh, really? Okay.
Not because I'm I'm a gothy dude because obviously I'm not, but there's something about it. There's something about that image of the Nosferatu, that living dead thing that lives off of, you know, warm living right. things and then retreats into the darkness. It appealed to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an archetype. People, it appeals to a lot of people, I guess. Mm-hmm. Strangely, my favorite, like, you know, universal monster from back in the day was the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Mm-hmm. I have no idea why, but like as a kid, I just dug that guy. Yeah, the vampire thing, though, it's kind of people have asked me about that, and it's like, it's just sort of a coincidence. Like, I needed the fucking logo, like, yeah. Because you gotta have some, like, I kind of feel like, in some sense, like, Black Flag and the Misfits, those logos, are, like, half the reason they're as big as they are, because they have this logo.
Yes, you know? Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Public Enemy, same thing.
Okay, sure, yeah. Smart bands have catchy logos, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's some exceptions to that, but it helps. It's not a band logo, it's a label logo. But like Alternative Tentacles have that, whatever that is.
Oh, God, yeah. I think Discord has that, like, in spades, too. It's just that really, like, janky, like, the box with Discord through it. Looks like it was spray painted. I think if it's stark and memorable and iconic, it's going to stick in the mind. And I mean, that goes back to like German pop art and then Warhol. To do something that's stark and iconic, it's a statement. It's a mission statement, right? Like this, boom, you're never going to forget the Sub Pop logo once you've seen it.
That's a good one. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Good graphic design. Like,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I just picked that because I had to think of something, and it was like this fucking cookie cutter that I was obsessed with when I was a kid. And it's been, you know, it's been around for a while now. So I put it on stickers and t-shirts and stuff like that.
It's very memorable. Yeah. So to switch gears, there's only one question that I have pre-prescribed that I ask everyone who comes on the show. It sounds goofy and trite, but it actually kind of lends people insight into who you are as a person. That question being, what is it that terrifies you on an existential level?
Okay. Existential in what sense? Like,
what is it that terrifies you to the point where, you know, you, like, when I was... perfect example. When I was growing up, you know, similar ages, I was constantly terrified of nuclear war to the point where I still have these anxiety nightmares from when I was a little kid about air raid sirens going off and seeing mushroom clouds in the distance, because I grew up being terrified that we were going to get nuked by Russia. Existential dread, something that's ever present, lurking over your left shoulder, dread.
Sure. Unfortunately, I think that would probably be Alzheimer's disease to me. I grew up with grandparents that had that, and I was, I don't know why my parents thought this was a good idea, but like my paternal grandfather was a, metallurgist who worked on the, Manhattan Project.
No fucking way.
Yeah. And then he, like, but I never knew him. Like, he was just kind of a vegetable, basically. And so in the 80s, like, from pretty young, I just associated old people with, like, just being zombies. Because I was around my grandfather and grandmother. Which is ironic now, because it's like, you know, I put out a record by Ralph Jean.
Yeah.
And he's, like, in his late 70s. And he's, like... his memory is better than anyone you've ever met in your life. He's almost like a savant. Like, he'll be like, oh yeah, I remember playing that show, and he'll know the venue and what day of the week it was. And this is like in the 60s. Like, oh, I was opening for Roy Orbison, and yeah, it rained that night or whatever, you know, and he's like, he's getting up there. But yeah, that was my experience with old age as a young person, was like just being a sputtering vegetable. And I am afraid that that will happen to me. So that does hang over my shoulder, you know.
I get it. I mean, that's how my grandmother eventually ended up. She was in her 90s, but just watching someone deteriorate intellectually and emotionally, my grandmother legitimately began to believe that my mother was her mother. It was her daughter.
Sure.
You're my mother. And then she'd have these like glaring moments of clarity where, you know, she quit smoking in the 80s and she started stealing. I was still smoking at the time. She was stealing my cigarettes. Graham, you quit in the 80s. I always smoked. And she's going, and Graham, who's that? Pointing at my mom. Oh, that's my mother. Graham, who am I? You're Petey. You're my grandson. It's like, what the fuck? Like, what a trip.
Yeah. I mean, so I didn't watch my grandparents like decay, but I did watch my aunt, which is pretty weird because, you know, I'd see her every year or 2 years, like at Thanksgiving. And so in a year, a lot can happen. And so it'd be like, I'd see her 1 year and then the next year, the change would be pretty pronounced. And before she died, yeah, it was like, she didn't know who I was. She didn't know who anybody was. But like, I sat down next to her one time, and at the time I was teaching myself how to play guitar and sing at the same time because I could never do that.
That's hard. Yeah,
well, I can do it now, but so I was learning these kind of easy 50s songs like Why Must I Be a Teenager in Love or Earth Angel, you know, stuff like that. And I started talking to her about that, and her recall was 100% on the lyrics of every one of those songs, but she didn't know who I was. And she, but the strange thing too, it's not like she sang them. She would just like in a monotone robot voice be like, each night I ask the stars up above, why must I be a teenager in love? Why must I be a teenager? I'm like, it's fucking bizarre, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's probably my existential dread.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
To me, that says that you're that you have empathy, though, in a strange way, because, well, not even in a strange way, that's painful, you know, to watch someone that you may not even have like a very close relationship with deteriorate. Who the fuck wants to see that, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre. I mean, my aunt was pretty boisterous, and like, she was one of those people that's kind of, you know, they're in the room because suddenly like they're just loud and kind of they take over the center of attention. And yeah, she deteriorated into just kind of a shell of a human being. But that's life, right? I mean, it's just a question of how long you make it. I mean, when I hang out with Ralph, it is interesting that he's like, you know, his memory is better than mine, and he's like got to be almost 80. I envy that. I hope I'm there with him someday, and you know, but I don't know. We'll see.
I think maybe I have no regrets about having a young child so late in life, you know, because my son's going to be 5 and I'm 47. It might sound selfish almost, you know what I mean? Because I'm that old and I have that young of a child, but my only regret with that is that he may see me because due to my genetics, he may see me deteriorate like that pretty young.
Yeah.
You know, because when he's 18, I'm going to be a senior citizen. It's kind of fucked up that I did that. But in the same token, you know, as the human race progresses, we're living a lot longer. Not that I agree with Social Security age getting knocked around like it has been, because fuck that. But
yeah, you know, but also, you know, I mean, not to be morbid, but you could get hit by a car tomorrow.
Fucking right. No, right. Yeah, you're fucking right. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of luck and chaos and unpredictability, so who knows what will happen.
Yeah, we get to count on that at least, right? Chaos reigns.
Yeah, I guess. Like it or not.
So if you were to kind of sum up your journey through writing, music, everything, And distill it down into like maybe one message that you wanted to convey to the world that you haven't yet with music, with writing, anything. Like what bit of wisdom would you like to impart on people?
I have no idea. No, I just work on things that I find interesting. So, you know, the books I've done are just kind of something I felt like doing that I thought was funny or fun or I was curious about. And then, and I don't really have a lot of, I have not done a lot of writing. And same with music. Like, it's fun to piece together songs and have an idea and make it into a tangible thing and put it out in the world. I don't know that it's trying to convey anything to anyone specifically. I don't know that music, I think it's a sort of a big question and I don't know that I have a good answer to it.
You're not a bullshit artist. I mean, that's obvious. You're not a bullshit artist. Everything is very, very honest with you. And you know, you're not putting on airs ever. It's just, this is what I like. This is how I feel. This is what I think people should take away from this. Like it's all simple. Not to say it's unintelligent. That's far from the case. But it is very matter of fact. Like you don't put on airs ever.
Well, I guess I just don't really care for a lot of cultural expression that's like didactic. Like I don't go for.
Agreed.
I mean, when I was a teenager, I liked the Dead Kennedys, but now I find that kind of thing really tedious. Like
yeah,
someone preaching at you about like. Like if you want to convey a political message, get into politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of my view. Not that there's, I realize that like there's a long history of protest music and art can affect people's emotions and persuade them to behave differently. And, you know, that's how propaganda works. But I just, for me, I don't know. I just find that it's a turnoff when something's trying to, tell me how to think or feel about something. So I don't try to do that. I just try to have fun or just make, I'm sure there's some exception, but like, I don't know, the stuff that I've done is just like, it's some project, some idea that I had that I thought would be fun to try and then I've done it. Because I don't have, you know, I'm not sure I have anything to tell anyone like you need to do this way or this is what's correct or it depends on what it is, but as far as anything we've talked about, that would be accurate. But I'm not trying to give a message to anybody on any particular topic. Although in the past I have done that, but not in anything we've discussed this afternoon, this evening.
I think that comes with youth, though. I think when we're all young, we all think that how we feel and the way we view the world is very prescient, very important, very earth-shattering in a way. Like, this is a very original thought that I'm having. Boom. Deal with it. As we get older, we start to see the world for what it really is, for those shades of gray that very certainly run everything. And it comes down to what gets you off, you know, what makes you feel good. And as much as I, too, loved the Dead Kennedys, and still to a degree do, I mentioned the word didacticism before. I cannot stand the religiosity that surrounds a code of conduct, a religion, any of it. We don't exist as humans in strictures. We don't. We're not all in neat little boxes. It doesn't make sense for us. We're way, way different than that. We're all very chaotic in our way, and what I think binds us is something as simple as like a great song, sonics, beautiful art, pictures, colors. That's what really binds us, aesthetics and intentions. And if your intentions are good, like really, like your intentions are good, You're just putting out stuff that makes you feel good. That's a good intention. You're going to get something back from that. And I think that's important. I think that's pure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't always have good intentions in the things that I do. I've done tons of stuff to piss people off in a vague sense, or to have fun, or to be obnoxious over the years. And I don't also have anything against proscriptive output. It's just in creative, in films and in books and in art and in music, I tend to like things that are just, I just like them because I like them. And I think that there's a place for, like, if you're going to preach to somebody about which economic system you think works best, you know, you can write an economic textbook or do an economics class or whatever, yeah. But I don't need to hear that from a crust punk band because they don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Right.
And so that's my turnoff with, you know, films that are preachy, like, I like good films that are just well made and interesting and maybe have some emotional resonance to them. But if a film is like trying, I mean, other than, it's like documentaries are rarely actually documentaries. They usually have some kind of agenda.
They're like propaganda for the most part. Yeah.
Well, and it is a thing where, like, when I was younger, I remember being persuaded by things that now I would definitely not take the same message away from, because I just think I'm stupid when I was younger. I'm sure I'm stupid now too, but so yeah, I guess that's all I'm trying to say is, like, in creative things, I don't really think it's just a bummer when it's like, I just think things like Rage Against the Machine are just a bummer. Like, it's not fun. It's like, you want to talk about politics and world history, that's great, but like, that's not why I listen to music,
right?
You know, there's great podcasts on history and politics that people can listen to, but like, but that's just me. I don't know. Other people can do whatever stuff they're talking about.
Well, that's what I mean by, you know, like you say, there were bad intentions at some point or nefarious reasons for doing things. To me, it still seems like your intentions are kind of pure. I'm putting out what I like. I'm creating what I like. You could either
I just wanted, you know, I just want things to be quality, like,
yeah,
well-made products, sorry, go ahead.
If you're going to pick up a little Fiodora record, it's going to be awesome. Like, there's no question. It's if you like rock and roll.
In the context of something like that, like, yeah, I want it to be 20 songs, a full, you know, full release of music that's mastered well with good graphic design, and it's been carefully selected, and it's not just thrown together in a half-assed kind of way. So that's my, I guess that's my overarching view for that stuff.
Yeah,
that's what I shoot for.
I think that's admirable. I mean, that's an admirable trait and focus for sure. So what's coming next for the label then?
I've been talking with Ralph Jean about doing a release of, he's recorded a whole bunch of covers over the years that I passed on in the past because I didn't want to deal with licensing because I didn't really know how to do that at the time. And now that's not really that hard to do. So he's putting together a list of potential tracks that he wants to do, and he's going to send that to me. And I have another one that a little too soon to talk about, but possibly another record by another solo artist in the future that would be like a, not a best of, but like kind of a 15 years of music or something like that. But it's a little too prospective at this point, like, you know, we'll see.
All right. Well, my friend, I will, I'm going to let you go, but listen, as I said before, and maybe to like, not let you go right away, but Unborn Ghost is phenomenal. The record you did before, Songs from the Empty Places Where People Killed Themselves.
Sure.
That's, it sounds darker than I think the record actually is. That record has it has its darkness. It has its darkness, but I don't think it's a negative record. I don't know if anyone's ever said that to you before, but it's not really a negative record. I think it has not a positive look, but a sympathetic look at a very dark subject. If you could kind of maybe give me your ideas about that before we go.
Sure. So yeah, that record came out in 2011, and that was just, I had written those songs and kind of, I don't remember the exact sequence of it, but I had written the second track on that record and I wanted to do something with it. And so I kind of came up with the other ones. And I had that idea for like a theme. It sounds ridiculous. I don't know if it is, but, I mean, it's a concept EP, and it's sort of a dead genre of music that was sort of popular in like the 19th century, which is tone poems, which is a horrible name. But, you know, you'd have like, typically in classical music, you'd have some composer trying to do some concept piece that captures some idea through music. The most well-known example is probably Gustav Holst, who did the whole planet cycle, right? And so you've got, you know, the famous piece is Mars, the Bringer of War, which is all bombastic. And but there's, you know, the rest of the planets he wrote songs about. So it's along those lines, and I just decided to do it on suicide. And because I had been listening to a Billie Holiday cover of Gloomy Sunday, which is a song about suicide. And so, yeah, I recorded that record and put it out. It kind of flopped because the album cover is very, like, not very compelling. It's just an empty room. And the song that missed the album title is just really long. And, like, it's a bummer subject. And especially in a digital format, the concept doesn't really transfer because on the back of the record, there's sort of a description of each of the songs and what it's supposed to be. But in, like, the context of, you know, streaming, you don't get any of that. But I feel like it worked. And I still like it. I think it's a good, it came out the way I wanted and I'm happy with it, but no one bought it because it's just weird and it's all instrumental, you know, like, but I don't care. Like, it's fine. It's, I still think it's, I like that record because it's unique. There's not an analogy that I can think of like a tone poem album that came out in the 20th century about suicide. It's fucking weird. Like,
but what's great about it though is, you know, nothing, there's no idea that's being forced other than, you know, like, as you'd said, the explanations on the back and everything, it's just its own singular thing. If you put the title out of your mind and just take the journey sonically, it's actually a lot of fun to listen to because it's its own little roller coaster, brief record, but still like a ton of fun to listen to because when you think about what it's actually speaking about, miserable, sonically, not miserable, not really.
Yeah, I mean, I also intended it a little bit tongue-in-cheek, like it's kind of supposed to, the descriptions are supposed to be sort of amusing, which, you know, but yeah, I mean, people, a lot of people assume that was like harsh noise or something, and it's, I've been told by a number of people, it really sounds like film soundtrack music, which I get that, that's fine, but yeah, I don't think it's actually a bummer to listen to. I think it's just a bummer if you think about it. But that all depends on how you look at it, you know. So,
but I think it's a successful record in its way, even though maybe it didn't sell. I think it did what you wanted it to, right?
No, I'm still happy with it. I just think, but I learned my lesson. Like when I did the other record, the album cover is far more compelling, you know, it kind of grabs you, which I think you gotta do that with people. Like they don't have the time or the patience to investigate what you're trying to do. You gotta knock them over the head with something.
I think when you look at both records side by side, I think Unborn Ghosts, like, it's really, talk about an arresting piece of art. You know what I'm saying? Like, just AB them, and Unborn Ghost has it all over it, because look, it's a woman bleeding from her eyes and her mouth. She has just white eyes and a rainbow mane of hair with a black background. It's psychedelic, it's visually arresting, and it is an adequate and accurate depiction of what you're going to get when you listen to it, which is not something that always happens with a record cover.
Yeah, I commissioned an artist from, she's Portuguese, but she lives in Norway now. She goes by the handle Hello the Mushroom. She's just like this street artist who does like this really playful kind of bright stuff. And she had done something a little bit similar to that. And I met her a long time ago in person when I was in Portugal. And so I reached out to her and was like, hey, can I commission you to do an album cover? And she came up with one other version, but that was her second version. And I think I'm pretty happy with that too. I think it also looks good as a thumbnail, like a tiny little fucking iTunes, I think. Like, this is the stupid shit you have to think about when you're going to invest time and energy into a project, is like, okay, well, is it going to look cool on a 12-inch, but is also going to look cool in the iTunes store? Like, which is just so annoying, but yeah, that's what I was trying to go for with that one.
Yeah, there's something to be said about that, though. The foresight to see it not only as a 12-inch, but also as this little icon on somebody's phone or computer screen. I don't have the wherewithal to plot something like that out. So hats off to you for that. But I've taken up quite enough of your time. The next time you have something coming down the pike, though, please, please get in touch with me again. I had a blast talking to you. I'd love to do it again.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, my friend.
All right. Good meeting you.
Good to meet you. Take care.